And it's very hard to know who it's safe to talk to about it. So by asking someone, you've just given them permission, hey, you can talk to me about this. So it's a really, really important thing to do. And I would say, if you're at all unsure whether you should be asking about suicide, you should be asking about suicide.
Welcome to The Consult Room, the podcast that celebrates pets and people. I'm Dr. Paul Magtalo. I'm a veterinary surgeon with a passion for the rich insights and stories about pets in the modern world that we live. Whether you're a pet owner, a pet professional, or you just love hearing about pets, then this is the space for you.
Is the veterinary profession in the depths of a mental health crisis? If you've been following the veterinary press over the last couple of years, then you would definitely think this was the case, with reports of industry burnout, dropout, and suicide appearing as frequent headlines. Today's guest has dedicated her career to this exact issue. Joining me is Rosie Alistair, who has spent over 10 years on the subject and is also an esteemed lecturer, international speaker, and published author on the very important subject of veterinary mental health. Rosie, welcome to the consult room.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Rosie, let's do a deep dive into the veterinary press. What sort of things have been taking up that headline space over the last couple of years?
As you say, it's about burnout, it's about workforce. There's been quite a lot about suicide as well. And I think all of those issues are really important in the veterinary profession. But one of the things that's really important in terms of how we talk about them is that we talk about them responsibly and we base what we say on facts. One of the real challenges around mental health and particularly around suicide prevention is that the way we talk in the media can affect the way that people behave. And there's really good evidence that supports that. And in suicide prevention, that evidence is so strong that if we talk irresponsibly about suicide and we exaggerate, perhaps, or we sensationalize suicide, then we can actually cause deaths that might not have occurred otherwise. That's how stark it is.
Yeah, so we're going to dive into the subject of suicide in a minute, but I just wanted to kind of pick apart some of these headlines a little bit. So, and I don't know if you remember any specific ones, but it feels like, you know, you're kind of like every time you open a piece of veterinary media, you are met with a headline. I mean, can you think of any of the last couple of years? I've got a few that spring to my mind, but can you remember any that stand out to you?
There's a lot about sort of soaring difficulties in mental health or epidemic of mental health problems. One of the things I do when I talk to vet students is I ask them, so people who are just starting out in the veterinary careers, I ask them what they know about or what they've heard about veterinary mental health. And some of the things they've heard are really concerning, actually, in terms of the kind of the narrative that we have around our mental health and what it's like to work as a veterinary professional. And this is really difficult balance because it's so important that we talk about these issues, but we need to talk about it in a realistic way as well.
I think that subject of people coming into the profession is really, really important, isn't it? We're going to talk about that in a second. But one headline I remember seeing, and I don't know if I've got the facts exactly right, but I remember reading it and thinking, oh my gosh, if I was thinking of being a vet, this would completely stop me. And I think it was something like, up to 30% of vets consider dropping out in their first 3 years of after graduation. Did I get that statistic right, first of all? Because I think it was something ridiculously high.
Yeah,
like that.
Headlines similar to that, certainly. And there's a lot of different numbers out there in terms of sort of people considering sort of intention to leave, as we might call it.
So why, and the other one I saw as well, again, which was there was a really high proportion of vets, and I suppose this was post-pandemic, so, you know, in the context of what we've just been through as a profession, but saying that there was a really high proportion of vets that were experiencing feelings of burnout as well. And I just thought those two things, burnout and dropout, to me were just, A, if I was working in the profession, make me think, why would I want to work in this profession? And B, if I was thinking of coming into the profession, again, why? And we are seeing that, aren't we, with people wanting to come to the profession. There's reports now of, are we in trouble because there's not enough prospective vets applying to vet school? So my question is, why are the press, do you think, fixated on these subjects, which really paint a really bleak picture? Why do you think the veterinary press is really focusing on this stuff?
I think there's a number of reasons. Some of them probably really sort of genuine and worthwhile, in that it is important that we talk about difficult issues, and it's good that we can. And there's been such a big change in my career, because when I first started talking about veterinary mental health at conferences in 2007, maybe roughly, it was quite an unusual thing to be doing, and you got some pretty extreme reactions sometimes that you just don't get now. So you occasionally get some more critical reactions that we're talking about it now, but it's really unusual to do so. Most people accept it's good we talk about this stuff. But I think you're right in that the way that we sort of talk about burnout, and we sometimes talk down aspects of veterinary work in terms of making it out to be this profession that will inevitably negatively affect your mental health, is maybe worth us pausing and thinking about, because we need to be able to have conversations about aspects of the job that aren't great for us and that we need to change. But we also need to talk about how this can be a job that can be very worthwhile and very meaningful, and really help create those pathways for people, so that if it's not working for people, we make it work for people.
I think the other, the big thing that I've seen, which is emerging in the press a lot, is about the relationship with clients. And I think I'll talk about that in a bit of the challenges in a second. I remember seeing that a huge proportion of vets have faced aggression, either face-to-face or online. And online seems to be an area that is of a huge concern. But again, is that something that you've recognised, and the impacts of that on our teams who are already feeling a little bit down about the job?
Yeah, definitely. And I think this is something that's seen across other areas of work as well. So this isn't unique to the veterinary profession. And I think that's not to say it's not serious, but it is to say actually that this is something that isn't just us. Other people are seeing this too. And people have talked more widely about sort of decline in public discourse, particularly around online abuse. And it's so important that we think about in detail about the impact on veterinary professionals, and differential impacts as well. So while some people might feel quite unaffected by that, that doesn't mean it's not having a very real impact on somebody else. And so we need to make sure in the supports that we provide that we take account for that as well.
So before we kind of dive into the subject of mental health and profession, can we try and do a bit of a root cause on some of those headlines that we're reading? What are the biggest challenges in the profession right now?
There are big workforce issues, and those are really affecting people's mental health in practice. And those are affecting people's mental health in different ways. And so if you think about kind of people at different stages of veterinary career, workforce challenges may be affecting new graduate mental health because it may affect the amount of support they get. There might be a lot of turnover in senior vets in practice or an organisation. And so whilst they might have started out in a supportive environment, that can change really quickly. And we know that, for example, support around particular skills in veterinary, so maybe particularly in surgery or in managing really difficult cases, where that's lacking, that can massively affect people's confidence, which can impact their mental health at work. So for new graduates, that staffing stuff is really important. Also, new graduates might be put in situations where they're being asked to act beyond the level of experience they have. And that's always perhaps been an issue with veterinary on-call work, but we're seeing that now in other contexts too. So people working in ways that, in quite unsupported ways sometimes in some situations in practice. Those staffing issues are an issue for people later in career as well, who might find that they're carrying an awful lot in terms of supporting an awful lot of other people, or that they're the only experienced vet in a practice or in an organization, and so they're having to carry a huge amount of volume of work, or they're having to do a lot of unscheduled cover, and that's really affecting their ability to do things like have family life, like access healthcare, like all of the things we need to do to be able to stay well, to have those connections with other people in our lives. And it's also causing difficulties for people in management roles as well. It's incredibly worrying and stressful to not have cover for the animals under your care and when you're providing veterinary services. And we know that that can be an issue as well. It's also an issue in terms of some of the people who are maybe leaving the veterinary professions. A lot of people who leave veterinary work aren't doing it because they've got something else they're really desperate to go to that brings them a lot of joy and happiness. Some of them are doing it to move away from something that is unhappy, and they're not quite sure where they're going. And that's a really difficult and uncertain path. So the workforce issues are affecting a lot of people in different ways.
And what do you think the root cause of those workforce issues are? I mean, I've got my own take on what I think they are, but we're not often talking about them that much, are we?
We're not. And it tends to all kind of just get described as recruitment and retention. And those are really different issues. And there are big challenges in recruitment. So some of the biggest challenges I would say in veterinary recruitment are around actually sorting out some of our diversity issues and sorting out some of the big inequalities in terms of our representation in our profession, which is a real issue. And one, I would say, one of the big issues affecting veterinary medicine is lack of diversity, inequality, discrimination, massive issues for our profession that we don't talk enough about. But when we think about retention, those issues are really important that we address and have gone and have carried on for a long time. It's taken a long time to get to the point with retention where we're at. And a lot of those are around things like people not being able to find a way to make this job work for them with all of the other things that they need to have going on in their lives as well. The nature of work has changed. The context of people's lives have changed. Vets are people first and then they're veterinary surgeons. So we have within our profession people from all areas of life, all backgrounds, people with all kinds of different things going on in their life. And to sort out some of the retention issues, we need to really understand those reasons why people are leaving. And it's not a single reason.
And we've had some really big ticket items, haven't we, happen to us over the last few years. I remember, you know, last year when I took this role and being, like you say, as a senior leader is a huge responsibility when you look at, you know, can I staff the hospitals? Can we, you know, meet demand? But when I started, I just had a bit of a reflective moment because we'd been kind of heads down in this perma crisis for the last few years. And I just thought, hang on, we've just been hit by Brexit, you know, which had a massive impact for me because, you know, 50% of our vets at where I was working, and I think that was a national kind of statistic as well, applications to join the Royal College were from the EU. You know, then we had the pandemic. Then we had the cost of living crisis, and then the war in Ukraine, which were kind of interlinked, and, you know, that resultant workforce crisis. And then we've got a rising pet ownership in the pandemic, and all these things just add to this kind of melting pot of, you know, you just feel like you've been hammered sometimes, don't you? And I remember looking at that picture in the sector and thinking, I don't know if we've even got a normal veterinary service anymore, a concept of it, because you just, you know, you're either short of vets or you're short of nurses, which, you know, has a complete impact. For the first time ever, we were struggling to recruit receptionists because there was also the great resignation of 2021 where, you know, a lot of people were just going, oh, I don't want to do that anymore. I want to go and do something else. And because there was a workforce shortage globally, you could just leave and go and do something else. So I just feel like the last few years, we've just been literally chasing our tails, haven't we? And it's been really difficult to get on top of some of these issues.
It has been. And I think a lot of people have kind of been running at maybe like in a sort of colloquial way, a sort of 95% burnout. So not in a very technical way of measuring burnout, but a feeling of I'm almost not coping. And I think a lot of people in the veterinary sector have been feeling that way for quite a long time. And what we're starting to hear is people saying, I just can't see an end to it, because we're used in veterinary medicine to coping with really unexpected things and to dealing with crisis. That's part of our job and it's something we're all really good at. But when you can't see an end to it, and when it feels like, as you say, you're kind of just lurching from one thing to another and there isn't really a period of returning to something that feels okay or something that feels like normal, then that's really hard for people. People need that decompression time. They need recovery time. They need time to breathe, to think, to recover, and then to feel good again, to go back and keep doing that. And when people don't get that, it will have an effect on them.
And I completely agree. And I, you know, it just made me think there as you were talking that we are actually quite a traditional profession, aren't we? And it takes a long time for us to change as a profession. And I feel like a lot of change has been inflicted upon us in a short space of time. And I just don't think that the profession is, you know, prepared or resilient enough to cope with that pace of change. And I guess another really good example is the rise in kind of the landscape of corporate versus independent practice. There's been this really fast accelerated growth, haven't there, of corporate takeover, which has completely changed the operating landscape of the veterinary profession. And you'll be very aware, you know, not so long ago, that the CMA have launched an investigation into the rising cost of vet fees. So, you know, and it feels like that's something that has been out of the profession's control as a result of this changing landscape of ownership. But the public, you know, perception of that has been very much like vets are all money grabbers. And the reality is, isn't it, that the vet that you see in the consult room has got absolutely no say in the prices or the charges of what they're, you know, recommending. It's all set, you know, by the leaders of whatever organization they work for. But the bashing, the vet bashing, comes to that individual, doesn't it? And it has a massive impact, doesn't it?
It does have a massive impact, yeah. And I think you explained it so well there, that people are being blamed for, or being attacked for, or being abused for something they feel they don't have any control over. And that's incredibly difficult, because whilst if everything else was going well, it might feel like, yeah, this is okay, I can deal with this, I'll use all the skills that I have just to manage this situation. When everything else already feels tough, that can just feel like one thing too many, and it can just feel overwhelming. And it's really understandable that people are saying, you know, this feels like an attack, it feels like we're being very criticized. Because when you look at some of the language, you know, just in since the CMA's announcement, you know, there has been stuff that's been very unreasonable that's been said about vets, and really hasn't taken into account that, yes, the majority of vets that people will see really don't have a say in things like pricing. But as you say, the public just don't have any awareness of that. And it's really tough for people, really tough.
I mean, my experience of vets, and this is pretty global in all the areas that I've worked, is they're really bad at pricing up. They don't always put everything on there. And if I was running a veterinary business, I'd be, you know, constantly saying to people, can you make sure you price up correctly? But they often don't. And that's the reality. You know, as a business owner, you're probably getting quite frustrated by vets who are really main drivers are to help pets, aren't they? And people, that's basically what people are doing. You don't really get any, you know, significant financial or business training at vet school, do you? You're not in it generally for the money. And if you were in it for the money, you'd probably have picked another profession, if I'm going to be completely honest, because, you know, the rates of pay at vets, I don't feel, is kept up to a lot of the other sectors that, you know, have that amount of training. That's my belief anyway. But just going back to some of that, So I think that there was another factor for me that I've seen in this. In the pandemic, it felt like the landscape of pet ownership changed quite significantly. A lot of people got pets that hadn't had experienced pet ownership to any great degree. And it also changed the expectations upon the profession of what they were expected to deliver. And I felt in that period of time as well, it seemed that criticism and negative feedback and online abuse seemed to go to the context of society was also a bit cheesed off with where it was. But do you think that the attitudes towards veterinary professionals have been generally changing with all these things we've talked about, and that's leading to more negative you know, criticism?
I think the attitude of society towards the professions is changing, isn't it? You know, there was all of that stuff about people being fed up of experts, and kind of this idea about who creates knowledge and who has knowledge and what is expertise. And there's much, much wider discourses around all of that that inevitably affect all of the professions, and vets are not at all exempt from that. And you see that in small ways in the way that you interact with clients day to day. However, I think, yeah, there are specific things that are happening in the veterinary professions as well. So you talked about, you know, many people becoming pet owners who haven't owned animals before, maybe don't have experience, maybe have some quite unusual expectations that maybe are quite different to the expectations that we might be used to from animal owners. And adapting to those and changing with those is something the profession's really good at. We've adapted to society's expectations of us and requirements of us over many years. However, it's hard to adapt and change when you're low resourced yourself. So when you are overworked and you maybe haven't had enough sleep because you've been covering on call for somebody or because you're trying to juggle family difficulties as well, it's much harder to adapt and change to those things. And so I think it's difficult for some people to be doing that right now for really understandable reasons. I do think, though, there has been a rise in abuse of vets and some really unacceptable behaviour towards veterinary professionals and towards the whole practice team as well. You mentioned reception staff and veterinary nurses before, and I think all of us who practiced as vets, myself included, know that sometimes it's those members of the practice team who sometimes get the worst of the abuse, not always online, but definitely in person. It's often the reception staff or veterinary nurses who'll get the worst of the abuse rather than veterinary surgeons. So when we think about the solutions for how we support people who are experiencing online abuse, it's including all of those people as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and I almost feel that some of the reactions that I've seen in my team to online abuse have been so much worse than receiving a complaint from a client in the waiting room or, you know, in your consult room. And I don't know if it's just because the profession's resilience is quite low at the moment, but I've had to really support some people who have been really devastated by online comments, specifically about online comments. And it almost, you know, it's so easy for people just to put anything now, isn't it, on social media without any basis or any kind of, you know, foundation of truth. But it really seems to disproportionately affect the recipients of that criticism or abuse, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And there's reasons perhaps for that. So while some people in the veterinary professions might feel they don't have much of an online presence and they don't really care what happens on the internet, you know, there's generations of veterinary professionals coming through now who are very aware of their digital footprint and are very aware of the permanency of things that exist online and may understandably feel much more affected by stuff that's written about them on the internet. And I think as well, there's a real... the internet and social media and online comments are a collapse of boundaries between work and home in some ways, because typically you wouldn't be viewing these online comments while you're at work. As we all know, there isn't a lot of time in veterinary practice for surfing social media. You'd typically be viewing it at home when you're tired, when you're probably a bit emotionally low resource anyway, because you're doom scrolling on the internet. That's where you've seen it. So you're probably going there because you need a bit of a pick me up. And instead of cute puppy pictures or things that might actually make you feel better, what you've been confronted with is having been tagged in something really awful. Mm-hmm. And so you're away maybe from support. You're maybe feeling pretty low already. It's a whole toxic mix of things that make it really understandable that people would feel bad.
That's a really good point, actually. So just going out, Rosie, if you were going to summarise mental health in the veterinary profession, what would you say?
I think I'll go back to saying that vets are people first. And so the veterinary profession encompasses people from a whole range of different backgrounds. So people with all of the different kinds of mental health problems are working within the veterinary professions, people with all kinds of different life experiences. So some people with very distressing concurrent life experiences to do with relationships, to do with family, to do with other things, maybe natural disasters and things that are affecting where they live or where they're from. And so when you think about the veterinary professions, it is important that we think about that context, because the things that affect people aren't just the veterinary things. We bring ourselves as people, and then we exist in this veterinary context where there's also all this other stuff going on. And I think in terms of the other stuff, there is a lot of stuff about the veterinary profession being in mental health crisis. There's not a huge amount of evidence to suggest that mental health now is very different to how it has been for some time in the veterinary professions. And that's partly, we haven't got really good real-time data. So that's not to say it hasn't changed, but there's not a lot of really good evidence to tell us how it's changed. There are things we can look at that might give us an idea. But I think in terms of mental health, my big comment in summary would be we've come a long way in terms of awareness of mental health in the veterinary profession. But I think we haven't come quite as far in terms of solutions, and we sometimes stop our conversations at awareness. And it's really important that we go beyond that, because awareness without a solution is not necessarily helpful when it comes to mental health.
Do you know, that's a really, really good point, and I'm going to come on to that I think, a little bit later, because I want to start exploring some really practical stuff that we can share with people. But do you think all we talked about before, about all those narratives out there in the press and things, do you think they are serving to perpetuate some of the problems that we're seeing?
So one of the things that worries me is where people start to feel that it's an inevitable part of being a vet, that it's going to really harm your mental health and it might make you at risk of suicide. And the reason that really worries me is there's some evidence that does happen. So for people who think, oh, that wouldn't happen, there's some evidence that it does. But the thing that worries me about that is if you think it's inevitable that your job is going to harm your mental health, if your mental health does get harmed in the course of your job, you're less likely to do things about it that might change that. You're less likely to think, actually, there is a better job than this. I can walk away from this bad environment. You're less likely to think, if I get help, I'll feel better. You're less likely to think, actually, I might have experienced suicidal thoughts, but this does not have to be the outcome for me. You know, there is a lot of help. Things get better for people. People decide to stay. And it's, I think if you're expecting it to happen and it feels inevitable, that is not something we want to create in the veterinary professions. And I think sometimes our narratives do create that for people. And we need to be really careful around that and think really carefully about how we can provide narratives that actually help people. So how we can have stories about mental health that reflect reality for people, that say, yeah, it can be difficult, but actually things can get better as well.
So on the whole then, do you worry about the future of the profession, or do you think we are on the right track in terms of we've started to talk a lot more, we're raising awareness, and the next stage could be more positive?
I have a lot of hope for our profession, and actually that comes from spending quite a bit of time listening to people who are at their absolute worst moments. So one of the things I do is I manage VetLife Helpline, which 24-hour support service for the veterinary community, and we talk to people in crisis every day. And the thing that stays with me most from that is the incredible resilience and humanity of people in the veterinary professions. People survive all kinds of things that are incredibly difficult, and they find a way through them. And I know that our profession can find a way through these difficulties, particularly if we do it together and we support each other with it. So I think there is a lot of reason for hope. And when I think about crisis, you know, there's different definitions of crisis, aren't there? But one of the definitions of crisis is actually being a point where you need to make a decision or a point where you need to take action. And I think, yeah, we are at a point where we can make decisions and we can take action and we can change things. When you look at how far we've come in terms of awareness, we've done an amazing job at that. We need to do the next bit now and actually make practical changes that help people.
Yeah, and I think one thing that I was worried about, particularly in the pandemic with the restrictions on services, was the impacts on animal health and welfare. And I do, you know, if you were to believe some of the narratives that we were a profession in crisis, then ultimately, I think there would be a huge impact, wouldn't they, on the well-being and welfare of pets in the UK. So I think we worry about profession, but ultimately this is potentially going to, you know, impact animals. So it's really important that we get it right, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Veterinary mental health, people don't often think about veterinary mental health as a One Health topic, but it absolutely should be. When we think about One Health and we think about health of animals, health of the ecosystem, mental health is right in there too, because veterinary mental health is really closely associated with our ability to work, to support animal welfare, to support public health in the way that vets do as well, and to fulfill that really important function in society that I think a lot of people outside the professions don't even have an awareness of, but people within the professions are really aware of the extent of responsibility that vets hold. And so it's so important that we support that and we support veterinary mental health.
So you might have already answered this, but why have you chosen to work in this area specifically?
So I always wanted to be a vet. I was one of those young people who just always saw this profession as somewhere I would love to spend my career. And when I started out in this profession, I came across a number of people who were really struggling with their mental health. And I knew a few people very early in my career who died by suicide. And it became apparent to me that we needed to do something about this. There was stuff that we could do. and that there was a position that we could take that was really hopeful, that we could provide support, we could think about how we can do things differently, we could try and make things better for people. And so my route into it has at times been maybe not the straightest path always, but it's been with that in mind, that actually we can do something about this.
This episode is sponsored by Superdog from Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company. Like all members of the family, your dog needs a balanced diet that includes a range of vitamins and minerals to stay healthy and full of vitality. Superdog's chewable, tasty braised beef tablets are packed with over 21 nutrients, expertly formulated for your special companion. Superdog's available now at Amazon, Ocado, Paws, Superdrug and Vitabiotics.com.
I know I've been in the profession for, over 20 years now, and I've had times in my career where I've definitely felt my mental health has been compromised. And interestingly, I think that's mainly when I reflected on this the other day, I think it was mainly around complaints. So I've touched wood, not had many complaints. You often do. Most of them are usually due to communication. But I remember I had a particular complaint, which I felt that was unjustified because I felt like I'd done everything right. But the client who was a doctor, interestingly, which I thought we might have a little bit more understanding, but had decided that they're going to report me to the Royal College and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And actually, the case didn't come to anything because it was determined that I hadn't actually done anything wrong. But I just remember that such a sinking feeling. And this, you know, I've coached new graduate vets through this when you get a complaint, because you just have this like overwhelming sense of failure and everything, doesn't it? And it's really bad, isn't it? And it's really interesting because, you know, 20 odd years on in my career, if I got the threat of a complaint to the Royal College, I'd probably be like, yeah, sure, no, that's fine, I'll go. Because actually, there's a few things I want to talk to them about, you know. And it's almost like getting sent to the headmaster, isn't it? But in a really overwhelmingly, I mean, that's probably quite a flippant way of describing it. But I remember the sense of just like, I just don't want to do this anymore. Like, I'm so frustrated. I think I'd gone above and beyond with this particular client in this case. I've done everything that I felt I could have done, and they still complained. And they were, you know, but really viciously complaining as well. And I just felt like, as a professional, they should have recognized the impact of threatening to do this, like threatening to report somebody to their regulator, you know. And it felt so overwhelmingly devastating. And I'm sure you encompass this, you know.
Yeah. Oh, you're so right. And it's something that I think we need to talk about more as a profession, in terms of how normal it is to feel really, really devastated by complaints, particularly ones that involve an element of professional regulation. So complaints to the regulator, civil complaints, those kinds of things as well. We know from quite big studies with doctors that it isn't just even experiencing a complaint or professional regulation yourself, even witnessing it in a close colleague can have an impact on your mental health. And some of the impacts on mental health from complaints are really serious. They can contribute to developing mental health difficulties, depression, stress, anxiety, other difficulties as well. They can contribute to suicidal thoughts. There's an association with death by suicide. So if we were thinking about areas that represent really high risk for people's mental health during career, I would say that yes, the time when you're experiencing complaints, particularly with regard to professional regulation, is a time of particular risk to people's mental health. And when people get in touch maybe with helpline or with support services and they're going through that, we definitely recognize that as a really important risk that's going on for that person. And yes, there are other risks, but that one is one that affects most people quite negatively who go through it.
And we've touched on support and how important that is, but at the time, the partner of the practice that I was working for was so flippant about it and was just like, oh, do you know what? This isn't a problem. I was like, oh, this is a really big problem for me. But with all their years of experience, they were just like, nah, this will come to nothing. But you just like, you know, and just that whole lack of support from that senior colleague was just the thing that made it even worse, I think. But just moving on. So I just wanted to, you referenced there that you'd experienced, you know, colleagues that had taken their own life quite early on in your career. And I, you know, recently saw a study that came out of Australia, which I just, the stats blew my mind. I think it said something like 70% of vets have lost a colleague or know of a colleague or peer to suicide. And I just looked at the statistic and I thought, oh my word. And it's one of these things that comes out with all these really high reports of how prevalent suicide is in the profession. Is this a true picture of where the profession is right now?
Yeah, so we are a very connected profession. So, you know, we train at a relatively limited number of training institutions and we tend to know a lot of other people in our jobs because of the requirements of our work. And so when one person dies, that affects a lot of people. And that's very understandable. And the impact of a death is huge on those people. So it's completely understandable that reports like that happen, and those figures are probably quite accurate in terms of sort of what you hear on the ground as well. I think the thing that is really important when we talk about suicide is you sometimes see reporting, and I've seen a lot of it in recent years, saying, you know, veterinary suicide rates are soaring or there's an epidemic. There's no evidence to suggest that. There's no evidence to suggest that veterinary suicide rates have massively changed. As I mentioned, there is a real lack of real-time data, but veterinary suicide rates have been elevated for decades, so for a very long time. And there's reasons probably for that, and we could talk about those in detail if you want, but it's really important when we think about it that we can think about two things. We can think about the impact of suicide is awful on people and we must do something about it. It's awful for people who live through suicidal thoughts and who maybe aren't able to access the support that they need, and it's awful for people affected by suicide as loss as well. And so we need to support those people, but we also need to do that in a responsible way where we don't need to say that there's an epidemic of suicide or soaring rates for it to be important. It's an important thing. And so I think it is really important that we stick with the facts when we talk about it. So we know from most recent UK data, which isn't that recent now, and we could do more up-to-date research on this, that suicide rates among UK vets are probably 3 to 4 times the general population, which is elevated, but it's not as elevated as some of the reporting suggests. Things that tend to get missed in UK discourse around this, I would say, is around veterinary nurses. So the studies in the US that suggest that veterinary technicians are perhaps at even more risk than veterinary surgeons. And we really don't talk enough about risk and support for veterinary nurses with suicidal thoughts, and really important that we do that.
Can you just touch on the reasons why those rates are elevated compared to the general public?
Yeah, sure. So usually, if you look at public health and suicide, suicide rates are usually elevated in people who face a lot of economic inequality. So people who are facing deprivation and poverty. So it's quite unusual for people in what you might call social class one, which is usually where vets would be categorized, to experience elevated rates of suicide. However, it has been the case in certain professions for a long time, and vets are one of those, where there is an elevated rate of suicide. So what happens when you have that is you look at occupational reasons for elevated suicide, and those tend to be several. So one of the most important ones is around access, what we call access to means, which is, do you, in the course of your work, have access to things that you might use to end your life? And that is clearly a very big issue in the veterinary professions. And there are things we could do about that that we're not doing at the moment. Secondly, it's around, perhaps, are there things about the job that might affect your mental health, that might affect levels of distress, that might cause you to become suicidal? And there are things about that where that could happen as well. Other things might be things to do with what group of people end up working in this job. So is there something different about the demographics of this profession? Is there something going on for people? And then something else that's really important is, I think, around sort of differential access to help. So is there something about this job that makes it difficult for people to access help? How accessible is support for people doing this kind of job? There's other factors as well, but those are some of the ones that I think are really important in vet.
So Rosie, you've worked with closely with VetLife for quite some time now, which is the helpline for veterinary professionals. What are the main reasons that vets phone that helpline to get in touch?
Yeah, sure. So VetLife is an independent charity that supports the veterinary community, and I've been involved with them for about 15 years now. But VetLife Helpline's been around for about over 30 years. And VetLife itself, in some form, as the Old Veterinary Benevolent Fund, the financial support service that we offer has been around for over 100 years. So it's a really established charity with a lot of veterinary professionals who've built up and established this amazing support service, which is run by vets for vets and by veterinary nurses for veterinary nurses as well now, which is a brilliant change to our charity. As well as the Helpline financial support service, we also have a mental health support service, which offers professional mental health help to people with unmet mental health needs. So there's those different aspects to it. But in terms of why people call the Helpline, more than half of contacts to the Helpline, someone is talking about concerns about their mental health, about mental health needs. About a third of contacts to the Helpline are about stress. We get a lot of contacts about work-related issues. So we don't categorize those all in one work-related category, but we categorize them as things like job demands, job satisfaction, other things to do with work. And if you add all those up, more than half of contacts are about work-related issues as well, which isn't surprising. But we get contacts about other things too. We get contacts about discrimination, about bullying, about relationship difficulties, about people who are self-harming, about people with harmful alcohol or harmful drug use. All of the things that can go on in life for veterinary professionals, we get people contacting us about. And that's exactly how we want it. We want to be there for people, whatever it is. The only thing that has to be veterinary is you have to have some connection to the veterinary professions to get in touch. And so often it isn't work. What I would say we typically find, though, is that people contact us, I would think of as quite late in the course of things going on. So people often contact us when there's an awful lot of stuff going on and they're already completely overwhelmed. And we would love it if people felt able to contact us a bit earlier. But I think as veterinary professionals, we often have a very, very unreasonably for ourselves high threshold for asking for help. And we definitely see that in the contacts that we get.
So our listeners really like to hear stories of and examples of the work that our guests do. So in your years at work in VetLife, have there been any cases that have really kind of stood out to you or that have had a big impact on you?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that VetLife does, which is quite unusual, and it's slightly different to veterinary work. So whereas in veterinary work, it might be really normal for us to kind of chat about cases and stuff, like maybe if we come home from work and we're just chatting with family, might say, I've had a really difficult day, I saw a dog that, and you wouldn't give all the detail, but you might chat. So in Helpline, we have this really unusual level of confidentiality where everything is completely confidential within Helpline. And so I couldn't talk about specific cases, but I can definitely talk about the kinds of stories that we get. So one of the kinds of stories that we've had throughout my time at Helpline is recent graduates contacting us having a tough time in practice. And gosh, it's such a privilege to talk to people right at the start of their veterinary career who are super committed to vet, you know, have put all this work and effort in, really want to be part of the future of our professions and are maybe struggling to find their way a little bit. So we've always had a lot of contacts from that group of people, and I'm so glad they do get in touch. But increasingly we're having contacts, I would say, from people who are having really big kind of complicated health issues going on, who maybe because of workforce pressures aren't able to always access the healthcare that they need. Maybe it's very difficult to take time off. Maybe they're struggling with cost of living as well, and so they can't afford to take time out. And as well as that, they've got a lot of other things going on, so maybe caring responsibilities, and it just reflects the complexity of people's lives. Quite often when people get in touch with us, they're in quite acute financial difficulty or quite acute health difficulty as well. And I think one of the things that always astounds me is how it's often apparent when you talk to people that very few people around them know what's going on in terms of being at work. And so, and even in cases where we're offering support, where someone's actually died by suicide, which is another part of the support that VetLife offers, is we offer support to people around someone who's maybe died by suicide. One of the things that we know about veterinary professionals is that they will often come to work right until the point where they cannot work anymore. And so something that has made me really aware of just going around in our profession is that there are a lot of people who are working incredibly hard to make out that they're okay and they're not okay, and they're really not okay. And so it makes you very aware of thinking about how we treat the people around us and what they might be going through. And there are a large number of people in the veterinary professions who are coping with a huge amount and really don't have a lot of support around them.
And on that basis, knowing that there is a lot of people that are doing a lot of work to pretend that, or, you know, mask the fact that they're not okay, what advice would you give either from a team member or even a pet owner or anybody generally, in terms of, without specifically knowing who these people are, what can we do to not exacerbate the problem?
Yeah, really good question. And I understand some of the reasons why people might want to pretend that they're okay as well. So I'm not being critical of them, and I'm not saying they're doing it wrong. I think, though, it's about trying to find space, even amongst everything that we have going on, you know, being late, being stressed about your ill pet, you know, worrying about money, all of the other things, to see another human being in front of you. And, you know, and drawing on our own knowledge of what it's like to find things difficult, to understand that that person might not be having a great time. And I think that if you can just go through life just allowing space for the fact that this is another human being, and that you can treat them with respect and you can treat them with dignity, and you can try and meet that basic human need to be seen and to be treated with dignity, then I think that's a start.
That's a really nice way of putting it. But I guess there are people that it becomes quite apparent that they're struggling as well. Yeah. So if you're working alongside somebody and they do appear to be having a mental health issues or crisis, or however you want to position that, or on the more extreme side, you're worried about them from a suicide perspective, what advice would you give to people? Because this is, I think, really, really important, isn't it?
Yeah, really important. And I think this is a skill that all veterinary professionals need to have. And not just for supporting colleagues, for supporting clients as well. I think it's a core aspect of our clinical skills, is being able to be there for people who might be in distress or crisis. The most important thing, I think, is about connecting with people, listening to them, and then thinking about what you can do to support them in terms of signposting, in terms of being able to be there and listen, but not taking everything on yourself. And that's a really key thing in figuring out how you're going to do this, or feeling able to do this, is realizing that your role is not to fix everything for that person. That is definitely not your role, as a colleague, as a friend, as somebody who's maybe supporting a client. Your role is to try and listen, try and connect with them, try and understand what it's like for them. And in doing so, you may help figure out, there's these services that might help, there's this support that might help, maybe there's this solution in the workplace that might help, maybe take a bit of time out, whatever it is. But you don't have to take it all on yourself, and you don't have to be the person who fixes it. And in doing so, that makes you much more able to listen, because the type of listening that you do when you're trying to understand what it's like for somebody needs to be really open-minded. It's easy to think, oh, I've had difficulties, you know, maybe with my mental health, or maybe I've had difficulties with clients in practice. I know what this person will be feeling. And it's really important we don't do that, and we go in open-minded and we understand what it's like for them, because it can be really different for different people. So listening, connecting, supporting, and signposting. And the reason I say that connecting is so important is when someone's in distress, and particularly if they're in crisis, it often isn't obvious to people that you want to help. And you might think, of course it's obvious, because like, I've asked them if they're okay, and now I'm trying to chat to them. But it really isn't. And one of the really cruel things about the way people can end up feeling when things are really bad is they can feel like maybe they're a burden on people, maybe that people don't want to help, maybe that they're just going to inconvenience you, or that you can't handle it. So it's really important just to say to somebody that I care and I want to help, but also to respect that someone might not want to talk to you. And if they don't want to talk to you, maybe figure out and help them find someone else that they do want to speak to. I think it's important as well, when we're thinking about sort of mental health conditions at work, to know that a lot of the kind of models of supporting people with mental health conditions assume that you're just going to see that person once, and then they'll kind of disappear into like a black box, and they'll emerge and they'll be better. And often that isn't how it is with mental health at work, because it can be really hard for people to find effective help for mental health. It does exist, but it can be hard to access sometimes. It can also just take a while. You know, these things take a long time to happen, and they can take a long time to come right. They can come right, but it can take a while. And so part of it's about, how do you adapt from that first conversation to actually being a really good supporter, and friend and colleague, and someone who can stand alongside that person? And I think through all of that, listening is really important. So making time for somebody and listening to them and trying to figure out what might help.
And I've heard you speak on this, you know, before, in, you know, very fabulous talks, by the way. I do love your talks. They're absolutely brilliant. But one thing that really struck me, you said specifically about suicide. If you're worried about somebody thinking of taking their own life, then just ask them. And that, to me, was just almost kind of, it's almost like it's a bit of a taboo subject, isn't it? Or the fear that if you ask somebody, they're then more likely to go and do it. But actually, you gave me some real kind of a light bulb moment where you're like, no, you actually, it's better to ask somebody that direct question, and you're probably more likely to, you know, turn their thoughts away from that because of the direct question.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's understandable that people worry about this, because what people tend to worry about is they think, well, you know, I know this person's distressed, but if I mention suicide, is that going to put the idea in their head? But that's something that we can really reassure people is not going to happen, because people have looked at this very extensively in research. Does asking someone who's distressed about suicidal thoughts, does that put the idea in their head? Does that increase their risk? No, it doesn't. And there's really good studies with young people, with all kinds of different groups of people, that say it is very safe to ask someone who's distressed whether they're experiencing suicidal thoughts, or other kinds of questions that you might ask around whether somebody's thinking about suicide. It's a very safe thing to do. You might save somebody's life. You're not, by giving them an opportunity to talk to somebody that might lead to other support, you're not going to make things worse by asking that. You might not always get, you know, you might get a bit of a surprised reaction sometimes that you've asked that. But ultimately, if somebody's not thinking about that, they will almost always just say no, and you can carry on the conversation. You know, but quite often you'll find things that are incredibly important, because suicide has been a big taboo in society for a long time. You know, suicide is still criminalized in many parts of the world. It was criminalized in parts of the UK for a long time. And so it's really hard for people to talk about it. And we know that when people talk about suicidal thoughts, one of the things people often do is they're kind of very vague around it, or they maybe sort of drop almost hints. And they're not doing that in a sort of deliberate way necessarily, but it's because it's very hard, and it's very hard to know who it's safe to talk to about it. So by asking someone, you've just given them permission, hey, you can talk to me about this. So it's a really, really important thing to do. And I would say, if you're at all unsure whether you should be asking about suicide, you should be asking about suicide.
And for people who have been affected by suicide, who've lost a friend, a family member, a colleague, what advice would you give to people that, for example, work with them on an individual or team level? Like, you know, because a lot of the, like you say, these subjects are so taboo, aren't they, that often when people have experienced it, it's very difficult to know what to say, isn't it? So what advice would you give in that scenario?
Yeah, it's such an important question, because it has affected so many people in our professions. It's affected me, it's affected, you know, I think, as we said, the majority of people in our professions feel they've lost someone to suicide. Things that are really important in the immediate aftermath is being able to talk about the person who's died, being able to use their name, making it okay to talk about it, letting people have space to talk, and to recognize that people react in very different ways. So, and that's normal. That is a normal part of suicide grief. So some people will absolutely want to do a full and normal day at work, because that provides them with some structure and it enables them to have a bit of a break from maybe what they're thinking about. Some people will not feel able to work and will just need to stop and will need to only think about what's happening. And both of those reactions are okay. So there's a really important thing for people who are maybe leading teams and understanding about being flexible to different people's needs. VetLife has published some guidance for what we call postvention. So postvention is provision of support after death by suicide, and the postvention guidance available on VetLife website is free for anyone to access. And it talks people through supporting the immediate aftermath and longer term support as well. I think general thing I would say around suicide grief that I come across a lot in the profession is a lot of people carrying a misplaced sense of guilt. And what I want to say about that, somehow it was their fault, that they didn't do enough to stop it, that if only they had reached out, contacted the person more, been to see them that day, whatever it is, we've all got these things. And that is a really normal part of suicide grief, that actually misplaced guilt is a thing. And it's very hard, but it's really important that we can make space to talk about that, and that we can accept that, yeah, I feel guilty, but that doesn't mean that it's my fault.
So Rosie, the work that you're doing in this area is so important, especially right now. So I guess it's a huge thank you from me on behalf of the whole veterinary profession. But you mentioned there some resources on the Vet Life website. Is there anywhere else that people can go to either look at your work or the work in this area that might help them?
Yeah, absolutely. So if people are wanting support right now, I would say get in touch with VetLife. Actually give us a call or drop us an email on a confidential email service, because sometimes it can just feel a bit overwhelming to look through a website if you're feeling quite overwhelmed yourself. Actually get in touch and talk to a human being. If it feels easier on email, you can be totally anonymous. You can make up a username. We don't see your email address. So I would say please actually get in touch if you're needing that support. And one of the most common things people say to us when they contact Helpline is, I'm sorry to waste your time, it's not that important. I will say in the 15 years longer I've been doing VetLife Helpline, we have never had a veterinary professional contact us who was wasting our time. It just does not happen. So please get in touch. Other places people can go for support, I would say, you know, if you're struggling with your mental health and you're feeling in crisis, then please be aware of mental health supports that are available. And I know that sometimes it can be hard to find the right help, but being aware of things like contacting your GP, contacting mental health services, those kinds of things are really important. If someone's experiencing suicidal thoughts right now, then you can contact emergency services to try and access help as well. There's some really good resources in terms of crisis support that are available as well from some of the big mental health charities. And I would say have a look at those too.
Rosie, that's amazing. Thank you so much for today. This is probably one of my favourite podcasts to record, and it's a subject that is very close to my heart. So thank you for joining us in the consult room today.
No problem. Nice to be here.
Raising awareness of these subjects is so important for both vet professionals and pet owners. Having more compassion for the veterinary profession will help us to protect people and animal health and welfare in the future. Remember, organisations like VetLife are here to support veterinary professionals when they need it most. You can find more information and resources at www.vetlife.org.uk.
You've been listening to The Consult Room. I really hope you've enjoyed today's show. Please do subscribe, follow, or share this podcast. I'd love to hear your feedback. If you want to get in touch or collaborate, then do reach out to us at theconsultroom.co.uk or connect with me on social media as Dr. Paul the Vet or Dr. Paul Magdalone.